Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. On today's show, we're going to the movies.
Could I just get a small popcorn?
Is anybody on?
Always.
I know what you're thinking, punk.
I will look for you. I will find you.
I see dead people.
You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
Waiting for a lady.
Will that do?
From now on, you do as I tell you, okay?
I'm gonna make him an offer again.
How about a little fire, Scarecrow?
60% of the time, it works every time.
In the office, baby. Going up.
We're going to explore the science of the cinema, as seen on the big screen and behind the scenes. We'll step inside the vaults that protect our movie history. We'll find out what a movie written by artificial intelligence can tell us about ourselves. And we'll meet the Brad Pitt of audio narration. He describes movies for blind people, and just wait till you hear his voice. But first up, given what all of us here at The Pulse do for a living, sound is always close to our hearts, and that's what we're going to start with. When you go to the movies these days, it doesn't really matter where in the theater you sit. Everything sounds great, from a whisper to helicopters in a battle scene. But what if I told you that one of the richest, most elaborate sonic experiences ever created in cinema took place over 75 years ago? Most people know Walt Disney's Fantasia with its whimsical animation set to big works of classical music, but this film was ground zero for surround sound as we know it. The Pulse's Alana Gordon takes us behind the scenes of this wildly experimental Disney classic.
This story begins in an unlikely place, the basement of a guy named Jesse Clapholz.
Hey, watch your step.
Okay.
I'm a semi-retired audio engineer living in Melrose Park, Pennsylvania. This is really a big mess.
At first glance, this basement is nothing special. It has old brown carpets, it's small, but it is an audio nerd's temple. It's lined with shelves of books about microphones, amps, mixing, stereo systems, acoustics.
Well, this is like one of the Bibles, Cyril Harris.
Handbook of Noise Control.
Yeah, that's a big...
Clapholz is a historian and former editor of the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society. And he has a treasure hidden down here in the back room. 9 filing cabinets. They make up the archives of John Volkmann. He oversaw audio at RCA, the company that brought us phonographs, records, the television. Volkmann was there from the 1930s through the 70s.
He was the top guy.
And he took meticulous notes of everything he did, saving handwritten blueprints, technical diagrams, even telegrams. Clapholz acquired it all when he heard it was going to be thrown out. He couldn't wait to dig in that first night after hauling everything back to his house. He came upon this one file, just a couple inches thick.
I just started looking through all the drawers, and I came upon this Fantasia folder. And I was up all night just studying the folder. It was just so fascinating.
He shows it to me. It's labeled Fantasound.
I discovered America when I saw the folder. I was like, wow, this is really cool. These are some of the measurements he made. This is the installation manual for installation.
Clapholz flips through Volkmann's notes.
Pretty complicated. There's a lot going on.
They document the technical development of sound for the film Fantasia. It all happened back in the late 1930s. These days, Fantasia, with that mischievously cute, wizard hat-wearing Mickey Mouse, has become a staple in family households, as have those tiny sugar plum fairies and prehistoric dinosaurs. But to Clapholz, a historian of audio mixing, the film represents a lot more. In these behind-the-scenes notes, he saw the birth of surround sound. Fantasia was a major step at that time. It was only a decade earlier, in the 1920s, that movies really started to use sound at all, with the first talkies. The audio wasn't great, and it could be clunky.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
But then heading into the 1930s, RCA and Bell Laboratories especially were moving the needle forward in major ways, experimenting with how sound was recorded and then played back. Both companies had been teaming up with a cultural icon at that time, Leopold Stokowski, one of the most famous conductors of all time. He led the Philadelphia Orchestra. Here he is in a 1972 interview with the BBC.
I love very much cinema. I think it's an immense and extraordinary medium.
Stokowski was a big innovator at that time. He was known for his fierce drive to find new ways to make music sound interesting and bring it to the masses. He brought the orchestra to radios, phonographs, and to film, occasionally conducting on the big screen himself.
May we, Mr. Stokowski?
Which one will you sing?
Traviata.
He was also known for his wild hair, tabloid romances, and strong personality. He wanted full control over every note, every detail of how the music sounded. A lot of Stokowski's big experiments with Bell Labs and RCA happened in the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. It's a beautiful old European-style opera house with plush red seats, a crystal chandelier, and gold-leaf tiers that's still in use today. Stokowski had turned the basement into a sort of recording lab that was full of equipment. Sometimes the orchestra didn't even know what was going on below them. Meanwhile, Walt Disney had been developing these animated shorts that were scored to music back in California. He was innovating with Technicolor and optical film that allowed for better recording of sound. Their two paths collided in 1937. The story goes that Disney met up with Stokowski at a restaurant in California. Here's how Disney himself recalled it in a documentary about the making of the film.
I was doing this Sorcerer's Apprentice with Mickey Mouse, and I happened to have dinner one night with Stokowski. And Stokowski said, oh, I would love to conduct that for you.
A partnership was forged. They went ahead and made the Sorcerer's Apprentice out in L.A., thinking it would be an animated short. But they realized it could be bigger than that, much bigger.
Disney said to me one day, you know, I like this so much, I'd like to make a long picture, bring in other
And before I knew it, so I ended up spending $400,000 getting music with Stokowski.
And Bach and all the great masters.
And so Fantasia, a film that would consist of several animated segments, was born. They wanted to go all out. Disney had hoped to film it in 3D and even bring in smells so audiences would be showered with scents of flowers or even gunpowder during select segments. All of that proved to be too big of a lift, so he and Stokowski threw their energy into sound. But how to make an orchestra sound bigger than life in theaters was a challenge. Ultimately, they set out to capture the Philadelphia Orchestra, who, under Stokowski, knew how to create a rich sound in their home base, the Academy of Music. Stokowski, remember, had already turned it into a sort of recording lab. Again, audio engineer Jesse Klapholz, who later discovered those RCA Fantasound manuals.
The whole orchestra recorded all at one time in Philadelphia.
Nearly three dozen mics were placed around the concert hall stage.
So you could have strings on one, basses on another, percussion on another.
They were all then recorded on different tracks. And below them, engineers and technicians filled the basement, following the music in real time, even muting or silencing mics when their assigned section wasn't playing. That was the recording part. But Fantasound had another key element: post-production.
They had the eight recorders going and they just had a mixer.
Klapholz says it was in this process that engineers developed a lot of the behind-the-scenes sound techniques that are taken for granted today, that make sound move through space. That included multi-track recording, overdubbing, the use of click tracks, and the development of devices that could control and balance sound.
This thing was incredible. It was put together with gears and bicycle chain sprockets.
But in order to pull this off, Fantasia needed one final thing: a special playback system. Here's Stokowski in a documentary by journalist Steve Cohen that aired on WHYY in 1969.
We had in mind, or Disney had in mind, that what is seen on the screen in Fantasia sometimes had motion, and that motion could be reproduced also for the listener sitting in the theater.
A lot of elaborate preparation went into making this work. Here's the late Bill Garrity, Disney's chief engineer who oversaw Fantasound, speaking on that same WHYY documentary.
The theater installation consisted of three loudspeakers backstage and anywhere from 100 to 135 speakers around the sides in the back of the house, tied in, see.
RCA and Disney had to specially design and then haul in audio equipment to theaters. Because think about it, regular movie theaters didn't have big sound systems in place. Engineers rigged about a dozen places with the Fantasound system. It became a much-hyped Fantasia roadshow. The equipment took up half a freight car, weighed 15,000 pounds, and cost more than $20,000 apiece.
That's a lot. It was quite an undertaking, even by today's standards.
Finally, on November 13th, 1940, Fantasia had its world premiere at New York City's Broadway Theater. It was a big red-carpeted event. Attendees were taken to their seats by Disney staff. And then the curtain lifted. The New York Times wrote that motion picture history was being made. Music pranced up and down the aisles and boiled over the theater arches, as one paper wrote. It all culminated with the eighth and final animated segment. It featured the music of Franz Schubert, again, the late Bill Garrity.
We had a series of speakers in the back of the house, which we switched manually for the Ave Maria bit.
On screen, a pre-dawn sky and a serene horizon filled with colors of a coming sunrise. And then, coming out of the speakers, it sounded as if...
The orchestra played downstage center, the choir was on either right and left, and then the soloist came in from the back of the house.
People in the audience supposedly turned around in their seats looking for the singer.
You're in the middle of a giant orchestra. It was designed to be able to play as loud and with as much dynamic range from the softest notes to the loudest notes with complete clarity.
It was way, way, way ahead of its time. That was stereo like there's no stereo today.
Time magazine described Fantasia as stranger and more wonderful than anything Hollywood had done. But Jesse Klapholz, the engineer historian who later discovered that copy of the Fantasound installation manual, says that success came at a cost. This seems like a hugely ambitious leap.
Tremendous, and that's why it just never caught on. It was just too expensive.
Fantasia, despite its revolutionary approach, was in many ways a bust. In a documentary about the film, Walt Disney described it as an artistic success, but financial failure.
That about did it, you know?
Disney couldn't turn a profit with its limited and elaborate theater runs. World War II was getting underway in Europe, cutting off box office sales there. And not only that, the reviews were mixed. Music critics took issue with Disney putting cartoons like Zeus throwing down thunderbolts to serious works of music. Klapholz thinks that original experience nearly 80 years ago would have been on par with cinematic sound today. Thing is, he'll never technically be able to know. Could we ever listen back to that sound of the original?
No, it's lost. It's lost forever.
Technology has evolved. The playback systems were too much for general movie theaters to adopt, and so some of the equipment went to the war effort, or was lost. Which means true Fantasound, as originally heard in those theaters, is confined to the memories of those who, back then, were lucky enough to experience it firsthand.
Alana Gordon reporting. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott, and our show today is about the science of the cinema on screen and behind the scenes.
I'm sorry about the other day. I can imagine what you thought of me.
I didn't think anything. Anyway, I woke up this morning and decided I wanted to stay. Can I see you tonight?
This is a clip from Julia and Julia. It was produced in 1987. It's sort of a supernatural romantic comedy starring Kathleen Turner and Sting. Never heard of it? Yeah, I didn't either, until I read that this was one of the earliest digitally shot feature movies ever. In the three decades since then, digital technology has made making movies a lot easier. Editing, for example, no longer involves cutting and splicing thousands of feet of physical tape. Special effects or color correction, that kind of stuff can be done largely with the click of a mouse. But digital technology has made life a bit harder for people whose job it is to save movies for posterity, like at the Library of Congress, which has a vast archive of American film. Our reporter Irina Zhorov is here now to talk more about those archives. Hi, Irina.
Hi, Maiken.
Now, the Library of Congress is sort of the keeper of our cultural heritage. How many movies do they have, and when does their collection start?
So they've actually been receiving films as far back as the 19th century, late 19th century, mostly from their copyright office. Right now, they have millions of feet of film in vaults. It's in a mountain in Virginia. The mountain actually used to hold gold. This sounded very Indiana Jones to me. I wanted to see it, and I drove down to Virginia. I met up with Paul Klamer there. He's the library's video lab supervisor, and he took me down to one of the warehouses there.
It's nippy.
It was 55 degrees in this room, and it's where a lot of the uncatalogued materials are stored. There's old film machinery. It's primarily used for parts, and there's tons of reels of film.
Mexican standoff, sharing is caring. Fun with words, words to sentences.
Oh, look. Biography of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah. In fact, it could be old enough that he's on.
Then we went to another wing, and that wing was even colder. It's kept in the 30s, and it's where nitrate film is stored. Nitrate was an early type of base for film.
All explanations will be really fast because it's too cold in here to talk for very long.
The space looked like a prison hallway with metal doors like those of cells on both sides, and there were tags next to each door.
Universal Pictures, Columbia.
The reason the collection is split up in these cells or vaults is because nitrate film is very flammable. So if one vault ignites, water fills it up in a matter of seconds, but the rest of the collection gets spared. And the fact that we have these vast stores of our cinematic cultural heritage is actually really amazing. So studios copyrighted big films, but not necessarily obscure ones. Many of those didn't end up in the archive. And before TV made replaying old movies profitable, studios saw no reason to keep them.
There were legendary parties in Malibu where they burned nitrate prints of films because they just burned them on the beach. That was the firewood that they brought.
Movies that didn't end up in the fire turn out to be very archivable. You could put it on a shelf, keep it dry and cool, and it would be around for hundreds of years potentially. Then, in the 2000s, the library started to receive digital files. Archivists could no longer put stuff on a shelf. They had to develop a more active management strategy.
Well, we write it to hard drives, and then every 3 years, we copy it to the new hard drives because they're much, much faster and bigger. And then after some time, we'll write it to a tape. But those tapes, they get old, and everybody knows they're only going to last about 10 years.
So, Mike, and during my visit, it was pretty clear from the archivists I spoke with that they're on board, right? They've accepted this paradigm shift, but that's definitely not the end of the story. There's still a lot of kinks and issues to work out.
Like what? What are they dealing with?
It's just a logistical nightmare. It's also more expensive for now. With film, you had to invest in a good shelf. You put your stuff on a shelf, you pay for air conditioning, and you're good. With digital, you have to pay for energy, but also the time and new drives or tapes to constantly update. So it's like investing in new shelves every couple of years, and that stuff is getting cheaper and better, but it's still a challenge.
So are all of the files standardized that they are receiving when they get a digital file? Is it all the same thing?
Not at all. It's a bit chaotic right now, actually, because all of the content producers basically submit whatever they want. There's no standards. Sometimes it's even encrypted, which is no good for the library. But even when it's not, it's a hassle figuring out, like, what do I do with this type of file? What do I do with this type of file, right? Netflix has started asking for a standard file, and because Netflix controls the market in a big way, the library is kind of sidling up to them and saying, give us whatever you're giving Netflix. And that should be easier for them because those files, there's a lot of data on them. They can work with them. But that hasn't been formalized yet. They're just kind of hoping people do that.
What about all these old rolls of film that you saw? What's going to happen with that stuff?
So the film itself isn't going anywhere, but think about the projectors and the people who know how to use the projectors, right? A lot of that infrastructure is aging. So the library has bought machines to start the process of digitizing everything. Some of those machines they had to develop themselves. They didn't exist. So far, less than 1% of the film has been digitized. Part of the holdup has also been developing the infrastructure to handle such huge files. A single movie can be the equivalent of 160,000 pictures. So just imagine trying to copy that from one drive to another. You just think of the scale.
Irina, as the archivists are copying films over into a digital format to kind of preserve them for the future, did you get a sense, were they feeling nostalgic about film and this era that's definitely over?
These people love film. You know, they've spent entire careers working with film. But at the same time, they're pragmatic about it. For example, one of the people I met, his name was Ken Weissman. And the day I was there was his 35th work anniversary with the Library of Congress. Right now, he's the supervisor of the Film Preservation Lab at the library. And I asked him about that. He put it this way.
I have pangs of film's demise remorse, if you will. A number of years ago, I really came to grips with the practical aspects of it, because my responsibility is to ensure that we can preserve the films, okay? If film itself is on its way out, then I have to make sure that I still meet my responsibilities, and the alternative to that is film to digital workflows. So that's what we're about. So that's what we're building. I wish things were different, but I understand the economics of it.
All right, Irina, thank you so much.
Thank you, Maiken.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott, and our show today is all about movies. There is a movement underway to make movies accessible to people who you might not expect to be in the audience. Paige Flager reports.
I met up with Sarita Kimball in the lobby of a small movie theater in Philadelphia. She has a spate of freckles across her nose and short brown curly hair.
Hi, are you Sarita?
Hi, I'm Paige.
Nice. She's kind of a movie junkie.
I enjoy a good drama. I enjoy a good comedy.
She's also legally blind. Kimball steps up to the refreshment stand and asks for something called an audio description device. It's a small black plastic square with a couple of buttons on it. It comes with a set of headphones that look kind of like the ones that I used in the 90s with my portable CD player. The movie we're about to see is Florence Foster Jenkins, the one where Meryl Streep is a bad singer. We settle onto our seats in a middle row. Kimball puts the headphones on her ears, and I follow suit.
A narrow blue bar rises vertically, and two more bars emerge from behind it with names atop them. Meryl Streep, Hugh Grant. Glowing rectangular lights appear alongside the blue columns, which retract to reveal skyscrapers against a navy sky. The title appears over the glittering skyline, Florence Foster Jenkins.
The voice you're hearing is coming from my headphones. She's narrating every single bit of action on the screen in between the dialogue.
Mr. Bayfield gets out in front of a brownstone apartment building and climbs the stairs. Inside, he strolls through the living room, tossing his jacket and scarf on a chair.
Wow, I never realized how much of the movie plot was only visual.
As he busies himself at a table, a slender brunette woman steps into the room, lifting a glass from a table with liquor bottles.
Welcome home.
The narration is called an audio description track.
Just about every feature film that is released in the movie theaters has an audio description track. And that's we've come a long way to get to that point.
He's got a good voice, right? That's Joel Snyder, the director of the American Council of the Blind's Audio Description Project. He's pretty famous in his business for that voice and his audio descriptions.
Oh, flames God. From the stove ignite his padded chest.
This Hollandaise smells like burnt rubber.
His blouse turns black.
God, it's hot in here.
He looks down. He stands upright as flames leap from his chest. He tries to smother them with a metal spatula, then succeeds with two pot lids. Two singed spots remain on his blouse. Smoke fills the kitchen.
One of his colleagues even called him the Brad Pitt of audio description.
Oh, I don't know about Brad Pitt, but I've been, I think basically what it comes down to is I'm old. Maybe I'm the Morgan Freeman.
Regardless of what movie star makes the most apt comparison, Snyder is definitely one of the founding fathers of audio description, which was developed here in the U.S. back in the 1980s.
You know, it's so much a part of our culture, the media, television, movies, and of course, museums and performing arts. It's about providing access to one's culture, and that really is everybody's right.
At a production studio north of Los Angeles, a company called Audio Eyes has become a one-stop shop for audio description. They have audio describers, audio engineers, accessibility experts, and about a quarter of their staff is blind, including founder and manager Rick Boggs.
I think having blind people involved in the production process makes a huge difference in the quality of the final product.
Audio Eyes has recorded well over 1,000 hours of description.
Beauty and the Beast and Pinocchio, Toy Story, and more recently stuff like Love and Mercy, Where Hope Grows, Cabin in the Woods. Right now, we are at what I would call an explosion phase in this industry where each year, the amount of described programs is multiplying exponentially.
Some of their audio descriptions are even available on smartphone apps. Back in Philadelphia, Sarita Kimball and I leave the movie theater as the credits roll.
How'd you like it?
Actually, I loved it.
Yeah?
I like classical music.
I almost found myself forgetting that the audio description was there.
You really don't think about it. I mean, I'm just sitting there just having a blast, like, wow, this is good. I really enjoyed that movie with the subtle cues that I was given to help me understand some of the things that visually I would not have been able to observe.
The audio description track wasn't perfect. Sometimes it would be too quiet and I couldn't hear it over the movie's soundtrack, and once it even cut out altogether. But to Kimball, those things don't matter much. She's been legally blind for 35 years now, and she's just glad that she can enjoy going to the movies again. For The Pulse, I'm Paige Flager.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is all about movies. Films often get criticized for glorifying bad behavior, sex, drugs, violence, booze. And there's been a 15-year tug of war over how smoking is depicted in the movies. The latest lawsuit claims that the Motion Picture Association of America has misled parents by giving PG or PG-13 ratings to films that include smoking. The Pulse's Tanya English takes a look at the tension between artistry and public health.
When a movie hero strikes a match and lights a cigarette, it means something. New York Times critic Aljean Harmetz analyzed smoking in the movies, and she noticed that whoever controls the cigarettes dominates the room.
Marla, the big tourist. Her lie reflected my lie. And suddenly, I felt nothing.
In the movie Fight Club, the narrator, an everyman named Jack, is unnerved and haunted by the mysterious chain smoker Marla.
If I did have a tumor, I'd name it Marla.
Betty Davis and Gary Cooper got payola to smoke on film in the golden age of Hollywood.
Shall we just have a cigarette on it?
Yes.
But things began to change in 1998. That's when a lawsuit forced the tobacco industry to stop paying for product placements. Jim Sargent, a health researcher at Dartmouth University, showed that the more adolescents watch movies with smoking, the more likely they are to start smoking. He says if a movie gets an R rating for dropping the F-bomb twice,
they ought to rate it for something that could get them addicted for the rest of their life and have economic consequences that are profound and ultimately kill them.
When Sargent was young, smoking was everywhere in the movies. It's hard to remember that time, but smoking was also in the commercials before the movies.
Dum, dum, da-da, 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 it was come to where the flavor is. Come to Marlboro Country.
At the University of California, San Francisco, health researcher Stanton Glantz doesn't mind if you call him a crusader. He's been uncovering tobacco industry secrets since the 1970s. And in the 1990s, he started buying full-page ads in Variety and other movie industry magazines.
If they're making a product which is being sold to children, they shouldn't be making the children sick. And that's what they're doing. They're doing it just as much as if they were putting arsenic in the popcorn.
About half of the smoking occurrences that young people see on film come from G, PG, and PG-13 rated films.
The CDC has estimated that on-screen smoking in films is going to lead to the premature deaths of a million kids who are alive today.
There's a long list of those movies that include smoking.
Zoolander 2, Race, Eddie the Eagle, X-Men the Apocalypse, Barbershop, The Next Cut, Mother's Day, The Meddler, The Magnificent Seven.
Next to the rating, where it says PG-13 or R, there are some content descriptors.
Dan Romer from the Annenberg Public Policy Center also studies the influence of media and entertainment on kids.
And in there, they talk about things that might be of concern to parents. One of those things would be smoking.
But over the years, he's taken a more moderate stance on smoking in the movies. Some health advocates say any film that shows smoking should get an R rating, but that would cut into a movie's potential box office sales. So to avoid that financial hit, Romer says the movie studios are pretty good at policing themselves. But there's some disagreement. Romer's more hardcore colleagues complained about a cartoon movie called Rango.
Yeah, that's right, hombres. Place I come from, we kill a man before breakfast just to work up an appetite.
Rango is an animated lizard who becomes a sheriff in a Wild West town.
We eat him.
The Annenberg team reviewed the film looking for cigarettes.
And we watched it the first time, we couldn't see it. We watched it the second time, and there's one scene with, it looked like a frog smoking a cigar. And it was like, first of all, ridiculous, and second of all, very hard to see. And to us, you know, you know, we're not going to, you know, fall on a sword over something like that.
Romer says smoking in film has shaped behavior and what society considers normal and proper.
What's happened is that within our culture now, smoking a cigarette has become pretty unpopular, so that even adolescents don't think it's that smart to do. Adolescents are, I think, less inclined to even model it when they see it.
It works the other way, too. Society's changing attitudes shape what filmmakers decide to put in the movies. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
It's the movie edition of The Pulse, and coming up, will artificial intelligence replace screenwriters?
It's completely constructed of the same time.
It's all about you to be true.
You didn't even watch the movie with the rest of the base.
I don't know.
I don't care.
I guess we're not quite there yet. Still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY, providing comprehensive cancer care with treatment options like intraoperative radiation therapy that delivers radiation during surgery to help reduce treatment time and get patients back to their lives faster. At Cancer Treatment Centers of America, they treat every stage of cancer. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America. Care that never quits.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is all about movies. Let's take a look now at how science is portrayed in movies. It seems like science nerds love nothing more than to point out inaccuracies. In Interstellar, Matthew McConaughey probably wouldn't survive a leap into a black hole. In the Titanic, the freezing lovebirds were floating under the wrong sky.
I'll never let go.
Neil deGrasse Tyson was all over that one. Reporter Todd Bookman has been digging into one scientifically inaccurate plotline that pops up again and again.
For lack of a better term, we're going to call it the double conk. It goes something like this.
You know, where you get conked on the head,
and then lose your memory, and then maybe get conked on the head or have some kind of emotional jolt to bring you back.
This is Mary Spires. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and a professor at Drexel University. She also happens to run a website called neuroscifi.com, where she and her students blog about how brain science and conditions like autism or dementia are depicted in movies. The double conk is something that she's seen again and again on screen. The first blow makes the character forget who they are or where they're from. Then the second blow, or maybe a familiar song or photograph, snaps it all back into place.
Well, you took a pretty good knock on the head. No doubt about that. Good news is, you'll live.
The double conk shapes the story arc for the 2001 film The Majestic, starring Jim Carrey.
It used to mean so much. It doesn't. How can it? Harry, I don't even know who I am.
Believe me, it's okay if you've never seen it. It's also the plot for the 1956 film Singing in the Dark.
My name is... I don't know. I don't know.
Double conk amnesia shows up in an early Tarzan movie and a Tom and Jerry feature. It's portrayed several times in silent films. And of course, it's all over sitcoms and cartoons.
When Fred opens a door, kaboink! The rock lands right on his noggin.
I suppose it has to be done, but is it necessary to use such a hard rock?
Frederick has a hard head, you know.
Clearly, somewhere, there is a studio executive who really likes this idea. But Spires was like, wait, what?
It's really neurologically bizarre. And so I wondered really where it started, where it came from.
So she starts digging back to find the origin of the double conk. And it isn't just on screen. It shows up in plots written just after the Civil War and in Victorian-era stories. And then she wonders,
was this just in the minds of fiction writers? And I found out, no, it wasn't.
She keeps searching and eventually traces it back not to a writer or a novelist, but to a doctor.
So there was a man in the early 1800s. His name was Bichat, a French doctor.
Full name, Marie-François Xavier Bichat. He's an anatomist and a surgeon. In portraits, he's a handsome-looking guy, thinning hair, mutton chops, a serious demeanor.
Mostly he seems to have just spent a lot of time as a diligent student, and then as an extraordinary researcher, and just a lot of hands-on time cutting up bodies.
Jonathan Strauss is a professor of French at Miami University in Ohio. He's written about Bichat's contribution to medicine and his passion for dissection.
The winter of 1800, he opened up 600 cadavers, and he did human beings, and he also did a lot of work on stray dogs, I'm sorry to say.
This guy was not well regarded by French canines, but he was pretty famous in medical circles, even early in his career. And that's for two reasons. The first, he was doing what was at the time pretty novel research on organs and how cells join together to form tissue. And second, Bichat was popular because he did a really nice job explaining his theories.
He's very clear. He's a very clear writer. He has a sort of Mozartian clarity and poise and balance to his writing. People could make sense of him.
And right around the turn of the century, Bichat uses those skills to write a book.
In French, it's Recherche physiologique sur la vie et sur la mort, and in English, Physiological Researches Upon Life and Death.
And in that book, Mary Spires finds what she's been looking for, the origins of the double conk.
Bichat thought that if you got hit in the head, that you would be out of balance. So there was this idea of symmetry.
He spells out this theory that the two halves of the brain, the left brain, the right brain, work in a careful balance. They're partners. And Bichat explains that if one side of the brain is somehow injured, it throws off the functioning of the entire unit. He writes that the two sides, quote, cannot be different in their mode of acting.
He doesn't use this example, but it's sort of like the gears of a machine getting out of alignment. And so instead of complementing each other, they're going to be interfering with each other.
Bichat's law of symmetry therefore held that if you damaged one side of the brain, Well, you needed to damage the other side to restore harmony.
So was Bisha coming through with any evidence to support this theory?
My suspicion is that this was something that was just fairly common in terms of ideas, and he was just using evidence that he thought everybody already knew about.
Curiously, for a man so dedicated to science and dissection and proof, Bisha fails to offer any. Instead, he simply writes about how frequently this method of restoring brain function is reported as working. He's just pulling from popular culture, from these anonymous stories and anecdotes. Turns out Bisha isn't the origin of the double conch. He just gets credit for being the first to put the thing down in writing, at least as far as Mary Spires can tell. He was so wrong, though, about how the brain works and what could cure it, I'm not sure we should give him any credit.
Oh, you wouldn't be the first to discredit him. Get in line.
Jonathan Strauss says by the fourth edition of the book, about 20 years after its first publication, his editors had disavowed the entire brain symmetry double conch argument. Science had moved on to other theories about how the brain functioned. But that opens up an interesting question. If the medical establishment was willing to leave the double conch behind in the early 19th century, why won't fiction writers?
I think because it just has such dramatic potential, and it can make your characters do things that they wouldn't normally do. It can put them in situations that they wouldn't normally be in, and we, the audience, can be in on it.
Sally Baxendale is a neuropsychologist at University College London. She's written about amnesia in the movies.
So we know things that the characters don't know. And that combination, I think, is really, really seductive for filmmakers. And it's entertaining. It really works.
And so, to sum up, amnesia is still a medical mystery. It can last a day, a week, or 20 years.
20 years? Well, we'll be too old to be rescued by then.
There must be some cure. Could we try alcohol rubs?
We forgot to cure the captain. He's our friend. He's our leader. Besides, he's the only one who can signal those ships.
On the other hand, amnesia isn't hopeless. Anything can happen. Sometimes it'll clear up by itself. Sometimes a blow on the head will snap the victim right out of it again.
Beyond the double conch, Baxendale says it's frustrating to see memory loss so often inaccurately portrayed on screen.
What you find in the movies time and time again is that somebody will get a very nasty bang on the head and have absolutely no difficulties creating new memories, but they'll lose who they are. They'll lose all access to any information from the past, which doesn't make any sense neurologically because we just don't see that in patients.
For the vast majority of people with head injury, she says learning new skills and forming new memories are the harder tasks, not remembering who you are or where you're from. Bisha, of course, isn't around to atone for his mistakes, though he is still hailed in France for his scientific achievements. In fact, he's one of 72 names inscribed on the Eiffel Tower. And the end of his story, well...
Whatever happened to Bisha?
He died at a young age, and ironically, probably, we think, due to a head injury.
A cerebral hemorrhage of some sort. I think he was in the School of Medicine. He stumbled on the stairs and fell on the stairs, hit his head, only once, which may have been the problem, and subsequently died.
A single conch at the age of 30, a life cut short well before the credits rolled. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse, and today we're talking about movies. Take a listen to this clip from a short film starring Thomas Middleditch. He plays Richard Hendricks on the HBO comedy Silicon Valley.
So, what are you doing?
I don't want to be honest with you.
You don't have to be a doctor.
I'm not sure. I don't know what you're talking about.
I want to see you too.
What do you mean?
I'm sure you wouldn't even touch me.
I don't know what you're talking about.
What? I don't know what they're talking about either. This is a sci-fi film called Sunspring that has a twist. It was written by an algorithm. Hollywood filmmaker Oscar Sharp worked with his longtime collaborator Ross Goodwin. He researches artificial intelligence at New York University. And what they did is this. They fed a bot named Benjamin a ton of sci-fi scripts. And then Benjamin spit out a screenplay, which they made into a movie. I talked to them earlier this week, and they said, yes, of course, the dialogue doesn't make a lot of sense, but think about the possibilities here. Ross Goodwin told me this could help writers reach beyond their own abilities.
You know, one example that you could think of is a songwriter trying to write lyrics to a folk song, let's say, and they write a few lines and then they get stuck. They could have the machine generate plausible next lines until one comes up that maybe seems good, and maybe they edit it a little bit and then move on.
And here's Oscar Sharp. He thinks this bot has a lot of potential for filmmakers.
Now, in theory, what we might then do is have Benjamin produce writing that is tailored to, say, your influences, like all of your favorite writers that have gone before you, and then is tailoring that writing to your response to the writing that you're reading as it goes. So this, in theory, could be a film or a novel or any other piece of writing, and hey, writing is just where it starts, that is tailoring itself live to what it is that you most might want to see in the world. Not your idea automatically written down, but literally your emotional whim being responded to by all of your favorite writers that have gone before. Now, this is a long way off, but that to me is a picture of a new creative process, not a replacement of the creative process. In the same sense that when we gave cameras to the world, we weren't taking the paintbrushes away from the painters. So Benjamin isn't taking the typewriters and the pens and the keyboards away from the writers. It's a new tool for them. It's a new tool, I hope, one day for all of us.
And just to add on to that, I really do think it's a question of new interfaces for writing and new interfaces for creation. I mean, we've been using the same keyboard for over 100 years, and Nietzsche, who was the first philosopher to use a typewriter, really thought that it affected the way that he thought, not just about writing, but about all things in general. He said the tools that we use for writing are working on our thoughts. And if artificial intelligence can help us create new tools for writing, new interfaces for creative production, that could change the way we think about creative production as well and the way we think in general. So that really excites me, the idea that we could perhaps write with a camera instead of a pen, or just for example, or write by emoting, as Oscar described. There are so many possibilities available, and we're just starting to touch the surface of what I think is really a whole new era of creativity, you know, enabled by machine intelligence.
I actually want Benjamin to do more than just write. I want Benjamin to take over more and more of my job as a director, to help make decisions about design, about lighting, about camera work, possibly one day work with the actors. I'd maybe even do some acting. I don't know how we would achieve that, but we maybe will find a way. And by the way, if we ever did somehow succeed in something that was a total effective replacement, it was something you were watching and going, this is, you know, as interesting for me and as emotional for me and as useful and meaningful for me as an audience member as anything made entirely by humans, and it's made entirely by machine. Let's say it's that the one button, press a button, movie comes out and it's wonderful. Then that probably will have been a moment where we've essentially made a new life, a new, what you might as well say is a new sort of human. But that human will have been made out of millions of other humans that have been poured in the first place. So all of those things, they'd be living science fiction, and we're preposterously far from them happening. But none of them have to be frightening. I think all of them can be this exciting prospect in the way that science throughout history has enabled humans to do more and do things they've never done.
Oscar Sharp and Ross Goodwin collaborated in creating the movie Sunspring, which was written by a bot named Benjamin. We have a long version of our interview with the two of them on our SoundCloud, WHYY, The Pulse. With a mousy hair, but her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. And that's it for our movie edition. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Irina Zhorov. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. If you missed any part of our movie show or want to check out previous episodes of The Pulse, you can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're on iTunes, leave us a review. It's good for us to know how we're doing, and it's the best way to help other people find The Pulse, too. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Who's in the best-selling show? Is there life on Mars? Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. On America's tortured brow, that Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame, 'cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hordes, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Rule Britannia is out of bounds, to my mother, my dog and clowns. But the film is a sad thing for, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be writ again, as I ask you to vote.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.